Committee, I'll come to order. There's a quorum present. Representative Albright moves the minutes from January 26, 2017. Any additions, corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption, please say aye.
Aye.
No, those are adopted. Today we have the governor's budget and presentation by the commissioner for DHS, and we'll be walking through that, and Commissioner Piper will be moving through that with PowerPoint, and I think everybody has the full presentation in their packets so we can follow along. Commissioner, is would it be your preference to ask questions along the way, or would you like to hold, or should we kind of see how it goes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along the way is fine. I'll present a few slides, and then I have other members of our leadership team here to do a deeper dive on all the issues in their areas.
Fair enough. As you like it. Commissioner, please introduce yourself and kick it off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Emily Piper. I'm Commissioner of Human Services, and it's a pleasure to be here today to give some highlights for the governor's budget proposal for this biennium for human services. As I said, I plan on just highlighting some of the key areas that the governor focuses proposed investments upon, and then the assistant commissioners for each program area will be here to do a deeper dive on the particular proposals that are relevant to this committee's jurisdiction. So with that, I just first want to start out by saying that everything in the governor's budget proposals for human services is in support of our mission, and that's to help people meet their basic needs so that they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. And the governor's budget proposal proposes to invest and strengthen core services to the million-plus Minnesotans that we serve every month, the very young whose families receive help paying for child care, the very old who are better able to live in the community with the help of DHS-funded services, and the most vulnerable people, particularly those living with disabilities, who rely on us for care and support, specifically those in our state-operated group homes as well as in private homes. So this provides, this budget we really feel provides opportunities for all Minnesotans to achieve a better future. The governor's budget proposal has a strong focus on maintaining our ability to provide services that Minnesotans rely on, and this includes ongoing funding for our staff as well as investments in our IT infrastructure. And, I think one thing that I've heard, I've been commissioner a little bit over a year, and one critique that I have heard loud and clear is requests or a desire for the department to bring forward new ways to deploy services and to optimize funding resources that we already have dedicated to human services. And so I'm excited to talk about a few reform proposals in several areas, including healthcare, home and community-based services, and substance use treatment disorder. And this package of proposals generate savings through reform efforts and then reinvests in new ways of deploying services for Minnesotans. And we're also resurfacing in this budget package proposals that were not invested in the last legislative session. They were passed over by the prior legislature that are central to our work, including fully funding our direct care and treatment area, as well as funding our child care assistance program. Our proposals are divided into six themes. They are independent living, health care, direct care and treatment, children's and families, behavioral health, and better government. And you'll hear about, as I said, these proposals from other people who are in leadership in DHS in those areas. So the first of the six proposals is independent living, and these proposals strengthen the core services to enable people to live and work as independently as possible in settings of their choice. And within this area, there are three main reform proposals that rethink how we invest as a state in the people we serve. The first is reforming home and community-based services. And this reform has three separate parts which save nearly $2 million in FY 18-19. They are better managing corporate foster care to meet housing needs and safety protections for residents. It really is done through reinvestment of funding. It's increasing billable hours for personal care assistants and eliminating absent client payment that a provider of home and community-based services receives even when a client is not receiving the services but is absent and a provider is already billing for that day of service. And we know that some providers are going to have challenges and raise concerns about the loss of payment for full day billing and then these absent day billings, but we really feel like, and I feel like, part of my responsibility is to be a good steward of taxpayer dollars, and this proposal takes these reductions in billing for services not provided and reinvest them into providing additional services for people with disabilities. The second reform is updating rate setting for disability waiver services, and this package saves about $4 million in FY18-19. It modifies our disability waiver rate system to reflect actual costs. It establishes three new employment services for people with disabilities. And this will be a big lift for providers across Minnesota, but we're asking them to help expand opportunities for people with disabilities to work in integrated employment settings. We have very low rates of integrated employment as a state relative to other states. We have far more people with disabilities working in segregated employment settings, and what we're trying to do is to align our incentives and our payment structures with helping support people in competitive employment rather than financially incenting ongoing segregated employment settings for people. So we're able to make these investments for people to have more employment opportunities and modify rates by eliminating duplicative inflation adjustments and change how day treatment and rehabilitation providers services are paid. The third reform is expanding resources and services to enable adults with disabilities to live independently. And this package has a $1.1 million investment in FY18-19 and then has a savings in FY20-21. And it does this by expanding eligibility for our Minnesota Supplemental Aid Program. At full implementation, this provision will help an estimated 1,800 people currently on the program and 370 new monthly. It establishes services that support independent living by adding two new medical assistance benefits related to housing, housing transition, and then housing support services. And we do this through maximizing federal matching funds, which helps in turn us serve more individuals through our program. And this reform will assist more than 5,000 people when fully implemented in 2021. And it also supports people with disabilities by providing allocations to our county and tribal partners. The other proposals that make up this area are expanding our return to community program to enable seniors to move back to their homes after a stay in long-term care. We know this program is really targeted at people who are not yet medical assistance eligible, but they wind up in the nursing home, and we help them transition back out of nursing home care before they've spent down all of their private assets and qualify for medical assistance. And so it generates a cost in FY18-19, but then more than pays for itself in 2021 through savings to Medicaid. And then we have establishing new payment rates for self-directed PCA workers, and then maintaining access to current deaf and hard of hearing services that the agency provides. Our second area is health care. These proposals allow for more affordable health care options, improved access to care, and better health care outcomes for Minnesotans. And the key reforms in this area are first, health care purchasing and coverage reform. Overall, this package saves $3.4 million in FY18 and 19 and includes increasing medical assistance reimbursement rates for dental care, We know we have very, very low rates and reimbursement for dental care under medical assistance right now, and it's creating really significant access problems for people, particularly people on medical assistance in greater Minnesota. And so what we propose is reforming the way we administer our dental health care contracts as a state and taking those savings that we would benefit from the administrative efficiencies that would be achieved in changing the way we procure for dental in our public health care program contracts and reinvesting that savings into 54% rate increases for dental providers across the state of Minnesota and hopefully solving some of those really significant dental access issues that we're trying to address in our state. We propose investing in reducing unplanned pregnancies by increasing access to long-acting reversible contraceptives, improving integration of care and health outcomes by enhancing our integrated health partnerships program. This program saved a little over $156 million over the last 3 years and currently has 21 provider organizations and 462,000 enrollees. And then also the governor proposes establishing an option for more Minnesotans to purchase health care through MinnesotaCare. We know that health care costs are increasing for people across Minnesota, and this proposal provides a comprehensive option for Minnesotans who don't have access to health insurance through their employers and are buying health insurance on the individual market. And this new option capitalizes on the department's ability to leverage its purchasing power as the state to create an affordable coverage plan that would be an option for Minnesotans who buy their health insurance through MnSure. And there are one-time costs associated with this proposal for the startup costs of expanding our MinnesotaCare program, but then following those one-time startup costs, the plan is self-funding. And then other health care proposals include increasing medical assistance in Minnesota care payment rates for preventative and mental health services, increasing payment rates to safety net providers, and repealing the sunset of the provider tax in the state of Minnesota. Our next area is our direct care and treatment area, and these proposals provide responsible funding to ensure high-quality care and focus on the safety of the people that we serve and our employees serving them all across the state. As many of you know, I was in front of the legislature last year requesting funding for our direct care and treatment area to address the many needs of the 12,000 people we serve annually and the over 4,000 human services staff that work in our direct care and treatment facilities all across the state. And I'm returning this year with two key items relating to that proposal. One is to increase staffing at the Minnesota State Security Hospital to improve client safety or client care and staff safety. It's an investment of $22.9 million. And this proposal brings our staffing ratio from 2.1 to 2.7, which is much closer to what like facilities across the nation staff their hospitals at. Nationally, we see staffing more aligned with a ratio of 3.3. This creates 124.5 FTEs, which are new jobs, and will create the right mix of staff for that facility for evaluation and treatment to ensure that we're providing quality care as well as ensuring our staff and patient safety. We propose enhancing and stabilizing funding for our Minnesota State-operated community services. And first, I just want to say thank you to the legislature for funding fully the deficiency of $28 million that we brought here last year related to this program. These are the 120 or so group homes that we own and operate all across the state. They exist on an enterprise fund, and we run the program based on the rates we bill and receive payment for the people in the group homes. The challenge is that the rates do not account for the full cost of the program, which drove the $28 million deficiency that the legislature fully funded last year. We have done a lot of work over the last year to try and stabilize and figure out what the best path forward is to ensure that we have a more stable funding mechanism so we can run that program not in deficiency year over year. Our proposal this year is requesting $10.3 million to stabilize that funding. And if you think about, so it was $28 million over 2 years last year, which is $16 million a year? No, $14 million a year. We've brought the deficit down because of some changes we've made to the operating the program to $10.9 million, which is what we believe we need. And we've done so by converting some of our intermediate care facilities into four-person group homes and done some strategic discharges of patients that can be served by other providers, and trying to maximize the rates that we're able to charge for the clients that we're serving to drive that deficiency down. The remaining proposals include enacting the reforms that we brought last year relating to the Minnesota State Sex Offender Program, maintaining funding for our child and adolescent behavioral health services, and upgrading our security systems and electronic monitoring at direct care and treatment facilities. And the upgrades to the security and electronic monitoring hopefully will put us on a path where we have a sustainable funding source to make those upgrades as they become necessary, and we don't need to come back every time we need new radios or a new system for one of our facilities, that we put ourselves on an ongoing maintenance plan so we can make those changes going forward. Next is our children and families proposals, and these proposals realign services and help achieve stability, safety, and self-sufficiency for Minnesota families. In this area, there's four key proposals that I'd like to highlight. First is expanding access to affordable child care services for the 30,000 children and increasing payment rates for providers. This is an investment of $73.5 million in FY18-19. It increases child care rates to the 25th percentile of the market rate, which translates across the state to approximately a 7% rate increase for providers. It also conforms our program with the requirements of our federal block grant. Right now, and I talked about this the last time I was before this committee, our federal block grant, our statutes are out of compliance and our program's out of compliance with the requirements of our federal block grant for the State Care Assistance Program. And this proposal realigns our program to the federal requirements. We have until September of this year from the federal government to come into compliance, and if we don't, we face penalties from the federal government, including monetary penalties for our program. In addition, we're proposing to strengthen child care assistance program integrity measures, which will save approximately $16.9 million in FY18 and 19. And we propose improving child protection, foster care, and permanency for children, which is a $16.9 million investment in 18-19. And it includes providing full North Star care benefits for children under six, including child care benefits, increasing oversight of county child protection activities, and improving practice standards to better support better outcomes for kids. And finally, these proposals also include and support tribal human services initiatives. One challenge we have in getting kids to permanency out of foster care and into adoption right now in the state is that if a kid's under six, the families don't receive full North Star benefits for kids, including daycare assistance. And so even when a foster family wants to adopt a young kid, they face a kid under six, they face a reduction of about half to the benefits they receive, including child care, because once they're out of foster care, they don't receive those benefits. That's not true for kids older than six. They receive the full benefits. And so what we're trying to do is realign our incentives for kids so that when families want to adopt a kid, particularly the children in our system, many of whom have special needs, that they aren't monetarily penalized for wanting to bring that kid into their home permanently by adopting them. Next, we have behavioral health, and these proposals streamline and simplify access to behavioral health care by making it easier for Minnesotans to get the care they need in a timely fashion while maximizing resources. In this area, we propose to rethink how the funds we receive from counties related to direct care and treatment are allocated. So one challenge we've had, and I chaired the governor's task force on mental health this last summer and fall, and one thing we've heard is a real significant challenge for counties all across the state is when a person is in one of our facilities, so say a county sends a person from a jail to Anoka Hospital, that person goes to Anoka, they are treated. Eventually, they don't need a hospital level of care anymore. Once that person reaches that threshold where they don't need a hospital level of care anymore, the county human services budgets are responsible for picking up 100% of that person's daily rate, which is over $1,000 a day. So for every person that stays at our Anoka hospital, when around 30% of the people at any time don't need that hospital level of care anymore, the counties pay 100% of that daily care, and they pay that directly into the general fund. And so what counties I've heard say is they're being penalized, and then there's no way a lot of money is going from county budgets directly into the general fund. And the reason for this, or the principle behind this county cost share payment, is to disincentivize counties from warehousing people in our hospitals when they don't belong there any longer, and to incentivize them to develop community solutions that are lower intensity than hospital services when people won't need them anymore. But what we're proposing is to take a portion of that county cost share funding and redirect it back to counties to help support them in their ability to develop these community-based placements to get people out of our hospitals sooner. We have another key reform in this area to substance use disorder treatment, and it saves a little over $500,000 in FY18 and 19. And this proposal expands the continuum of care by adding care coordination, peer support services, and withdrawal management to the medical assistance benefit set. And it allows direct access to providers, which will streamline the process for people to get treatment when they need it. And the final proposal in this area is financing intensive residential mental health services for children. There's an IMD issue relating to federal funding for children's intensive residential treatment for particularly managed care covered kids on MA, and this solves that financing deficiency for providers across the state. And then finally, our last category of investments is better government, and these proposals address gaps in program oversight and integrity, accessibility to services, and workforce sustainability and sustainability and stability. And they provide for an operating adjustment for our central office and direct care and treatment areas to enable the department to cover increased costs relating to our employees while maintaining the current staffing levels that the department has. Just to give you some context, and I think I touched a little bit on this when I came and talked to you a couple weeks ago, DHS has about 6,100 employees, and about 4,000 of those 6,100 work in our direct care and treatment area in 200 or so facilities all across the state. So although that area makes up less than 5% of our annual budget for our agency, it is where the vast majority or the majority of our staff work, and they work at our community behavioral health hospitals, our group homes, security hospital, our state sex offender program, our chemical dependency facilities, and a whole host of other facilities all across the state. The second piece of this proposal is upgrading and modernizing our aging computer systems. And this proposes $9 million in FY18-19 and $20 million in 2021. And it'll move us forward on our ongoing modernization effort for our major technology systems that we use for human services and that counties use all across the state. And it allows us to leverage our matching federal funds to capitalize on as much of the current funding federally that's available. And I believe that I can't recall who in this committee that raised the issue. I think it was Representative Grunhagen raised the issue that he had heard from the counties about the availability of matching federal funds for particular IT upgrades, and this is really what that investment is targeting. We propose to strengthen our health care or our health and child care programs, broaden abuse investigations, and strengthen integrity in data privacy. And so altogether, these proposals represent an all-funds impact of $282 million in FY18-19, an increase of 0.8% over our base. Funding breaks down as follows. So we have our independent living proposal that is $50.4 million, our health care proposals, which are $32 million, children and families, which is $89.8 million, behavioral health, which is $12.2 million, and better government, which is $54.7 million. And looking just at the general fund, these proposals provide a general fund savings of $450 million in FY18-19, which is a 3.3% reduction from our base. And with that, I'm finished with my piece of the presentation, just sort of the overview. Lauren Coleman and Claire Wilson are up next to provide a deeper dive into the independent living proposal, but I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. We do have a few questions. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question maybe for both the Chair and for the Commissioner. And it is in relationship to the budget, not necessarily just the governor's budget, but the work that we're going to be doing over the next few months and the state's budget. And we've been alluding to what's happening in Washington for about 3 weeks now, but we haven't really put it on the table for us because we don't really know what's going to happen out in Washington with regard to the Affordable Care Act and medical assistance. But I'm wondering, because I've been doing a little homework to try and understand a little bit better from our perspective, if before we get too far down the path of diving into setting the state's budget, if we shouldn't dedicate some of our time here to understanding what the ramifications would be to the state's budget if they decided to repeal the Affordable Care Act and not replace it, or block grant medical assistance, and we don't know what that looks like, but it has real ramifications for us. And I know, Commissioner and members of the department, I have been asking questions and trying to gather information. I just don't know how to get it into a proper format so that we can look at that together and consider it. So it may be a rhetorical question at this point, but I want to put it on the table for consideration by both the department and by the chair so that we are fully informed as we're going forward in setting the budget.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy. We've been trying to, as our agency, putting together information related to, because a lot of our stakeholder groups and other people in Minnesota are concerned and interested about what the, number one, what the impact on the state of Minnesota for the repeal of the Affordable Care Act is, and then also looking at what the proposals are out there for block grants to Medicaid and the impact based on proposals. We're not exactly sure what it would look like as a state yet, but based on Speaker Ryan's proposal previously to block grant Medicaid, looking at what The impact would be on Minnesota. And the repeal of the ACA, we project about a $2 billion yearly deficit or reduction in federal funding for the state of Minnesota, and a reduction of over 300,000 people that have been covered on our public health care programs. With regard to block granting Medicaid, we're particularly challenged as a state because we have been really innovative in how we deliver health care. And so there are immediate challenges as to what the block grant level would be set at. But additionally, the block grant proposals that are out there are tied in growth to CPI. And so when you look at growth in CPI versus the trend in our public health care program growth, particularly for people who are elderly or living with a disability, that by 2030 we project about an $8 billion loss in federal funding for block granting in addition to the repeal of the ACA. And we've been putting out sort of analyses and things like that that are available on a website. I think the department either has or will send around a link to the website that has all that information on it as well.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And thanks, Commissioner. And I know this hearing today is not about that issue. And I appreciate the work you're doing. I got a look at some of the information you're doing county by county. So what the county, the federal dollar loss to the counties would be county by county, which is pretty outstanding. They're pretty big numbers. So I guess I will just put it on the table for you, Mr. Chair, that before we get too far down the path of setting the state's budget, it would be, I think, useful for the committee, if you would consider it, to focus a little bit more of our time and energy on what the hypotheticals would be, what it means for our state's budget, and for, of course, you know, our hospitals, our clinics, our nursing homes, who all stand to lose a fair amount of money, property taxpayers, of course, and the jobs that are related to that. I think it would be important for us to take that up as an agenda item on its own. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. May I just point out that the governor's budget does not anticipate these cuts, so the governor assumes that we're spending all of this money, that it will continue to be there. So I think in some ways you can't have it both ways. You can't say we're going to lose $2 billion a year and cut 300,000 people and then expand the public option and drain the health care access fund and spend the money. So I think we got to focus on what is and what might be. We have to figure out kind of a piece at a time, but obviously we will be greatly affected by what happens in Washington, and sometimes we can lead and sometimes we have to follow.
Right, Mr. Chair, as people keep saying to us now, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. And so we should, I think, be paying attention to what's happening to Washington.
All right. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, the 124 jobs at the security hospital, do you have a breakdown? Are all of those going to be line staff, or how many will be security counselors?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Considine. We can get you the breakdown. It's across the whole continuum of services. So before I became commissioner, I was the governor's chief legal counsel, and we worked with then Commissioner Jessen around labor issues that were brought to our attention down at Security Hospital, and brought in the Bureau of Mediation Services to facilitate one component of building what they believe to be the staff complement necessary for them to do their job safely and to treat the patients that they have there with the best care possible. And they brought forward recommendations to the governor, which the governor reflected in his budget last year and then also proposes this year. And it really is everything from keeping up our psychiatric professional staff to building maintenance folks, because a lot of the buildings are aging there, to security counselor staff, to nurses. And it's not just investing in the employee salaries, it's investing in helping maintain our employees. So more investment in the incentives necessary to keep the workforce that we have as well. But we can get you the specific numbers.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as we've talked about, one of the big problems right now is the forced overtime because there aren't enough security counselors to cover all of the period. So I guess, yeah, I'd like to see that. I'm hoping that a majority of it is going to be security counselors. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Considine. We do have Chuck Johnson coming up in a little bit, and he will probably be kind of working out of the big book. And so if you got your post-it notes ready, we'll probably be able to go directly to that in that portion. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I got a couple questions. Thanks for your presentation. Just one comment. Yeah, I spent some time with my local social service people on their computer programs, and my understanding is, but it definitely needs to be upgraded at the county level, is that if we provide $10 million of funding, the feds will match about $90 million, and, which I think should pretty well update the whole state as far as the local, if it's spent at the county level. So that's just a comment. But the question is, you know, I have to agree with Representative Aaron Murphy there, is that I don't know if expanding a public option at this point, you know, like Minnesota Care, is prudent or wise when we're facing, what is it? You think agreeing with you is funny? No. we're getting closer all the time, Aaron. I mean, that might scare both of us. But anyway, I think we should actually, you know, a public option was rejected even when the ACA was passed, okay? Because government has a tendency to subsidize what they offer and put private companies at a disadvantage and ultimately put everybody out of business, and we wind up with single-payer government bureaucrat rationed health care, and none of us really want that, I don't think. But just a general comment. Back to Minnesota Care. Government programs have historically underpaid providers, and this has created cost shifting to the private market. So the private market, since about 1965, private health insurance market, has been bailing out the government programs, and yet they get demonized for doing it when they raise their rates. So I actually believe we should move Minnesota Care into the private health insurance market and provide some tax credit subsidies to help these people in their income bracket purchase the individual health insurance. This would help stabilize the market. It would also provide higher reimbursement rates to doctors and hospitals rather than trying to prop up a government program, which with the change in administration in Washington might be on life support in a few months. So what are your thoughts about that?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen. Well, I think
one-word answer, by the way.
I think a couple points. I was down at Farm Fest this summer, and it was the same week that all of the people in the individual market got their notices that Blue Cross Blue Shield was pulling out of the individual market. And the governor's not proposing a single option in this proposal. He's proposing a self-funding public option for people to choose from, so that in 2018, regardless of Blue Cross Blue Shield's decision or Preferred One's decision or whomever's decision along the lines of profits, that there will be one option that's affordable for people to buy into. And it doesn't increase costs because it's a self-funding proposal. And with regard to the rate issues, the governor does propose increasing the rates for preventative care and mental health care as part of his package to address some of the disparities in rates that we pay in our public health care programs. I would say, additionally, although the medical assistance and Minnesota care rates are lower for providers, and that's something that we're trying to address at least in part in the governor's package, also as part of the Affordable Care Act and more people having health insurance coverage has come really significant decreases in the amount of uncompensated care for health systems and providers all across the state, which has been a benefit to providers and also a benefit of the Affordable Care Act. And so I understand the philosophical difference around a private solution versus a public solution. But I think that those are also considerations for the committee to get some thought to as well when making decisions.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just give you a little feedback on the, on those comments. One is that, you know, the you know, the ACA was supposed to cost $969 billion over 10 years. Now the CDO has increased the estimate of a government program to, I think, $2.7 or $2.8 trillion. So it more than tripled since it's been initiated. Government programs inherently, projections, especially in health care, are notoriously wrong, not by a little bit, but exponentially wrong. Even with Medicare, and I have never written a book on it, so that's why I got these figures in my head. In 1965, Medicare was projected to cost $10 billion in 1990. But by 1992, Medicare cost $100 billion. So they were almost off by a multiple of 10 in their projection. So when you use the word self-funded for public option, I know where the self-funding is going to come out of. It'll start bailing out of the general fund. And you're going to get into a death cycle of tax and spend and spend and tax and tax and spend. And sooner or later, the goose that lays the golden egg of tax revenue is going to say, I've had it. I'm moving to a different nest or state. Okay? So I really think we have to move in a different direction than the governor's plan or even as far as offering a public option. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. And just to clarify, Commissioner, you talk about the expansion of the BHP as being fully funded and not cost, having no cost. Do you anticipate a change of the subsidy level in Minnesota Care from its current 8% premium to something more than that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a premium-based product. So it proposes a silver and a gold-level product. So people would pay, it's a premium-based product that would be funded through people's premiums, averaging saving around a little over $800 every year based on a comparison from what's available in the individual market for the 2017 market.
All right. I just wanted to make the clarification that Minnesota Care is not self-supporting through premiums. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I have a simple one. I'd just like to know more information on the Minnesota State Operating Community Services. And specifically, what services do they provide that are not provided in other systems? And then I'd like to compare the funding and reimbursement rates with those systems compared to others. And then I simply have a question. Could we be utilizing those systems differently? And if not today, at some other point in time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hamilton. So the folks that traditionally or historically have been in our 120 group homes, they were people that came out of the regional treatment centers when they were closed. And so when the state closed all of the regional treatment centers, they converted to this four-person group home model. And then people had rates that paid for the level of service that they needed. When we introduced the new rate setting system and started to do that work, it became clear that the rates didn't, the banding in particular was a problem in the rate setting for those folks in our homes, and the rates were not keeping up with the cost of care for those individuals. Additionally, at the same time, people, the four-person group home model was set up to have each group home be full of, with four people. And as we take more people who have really serious mental health issues or other really complex conditions, they're not appropriate to be housed with three other people, particularly three other people with really challenging and complex disabilities, really vulnerable people. And so we wound up over time having our houses not be full. And so we paid the overhead of having a four-person group home and all of the costs associated with that, and we maybe had one or two people in the home because of their complex needs. And so these are people originally that came out of the treatment centers, but now we're serving people that private providers won't serve. So there's, although there are some people now that live in the group homes that have been living there for a really long time that probably we could find private providers to
take and serve. It would require moving people away from the only people that they have ever lived with since they moved out of the regional treatment centers to do so. So it's a really delicate issue. And then the new people coming in, there's no private provider there to step in the shoes to serve them. Sometimes they're coming out of security hospital. Sometimes they're coming out of ANOCA. And they've got really challenging issues that the state steps in and serves as a safety net.
Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm trying to be very sensitive with my questioning. And if I could just get some additional information, like I said, to understand what services are provided that are not provided in other systems, and then the funding or reimbursement rates between the two. The differences.
Absolutely.
All right, thank you.
All right. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, there's a lovely quote, you know, prediction's very difficult, especially when it's about the future, Representative Gunhagen. So, yeah, it's really difficult to predict what's going to happen, you know, even in a few years, much less 10 or 20 years down the road. But I wanted to return to what Representative Murphy was talking about and remind everyone that, in Ways and Means, when Commissioner Franz was testifying and he was asked about why didn't the budget have anything in it about the possible loss of ACA funding, he said the law requires the governor to put forward a budget under current law. And so that's what the governor is doing. But it would certainly be wise, I think, for both the administration and for the legislature to put forward kind of a secondary contingent budget. I mean, I don't think the law says that we can't plan for what we know may be coming, even if it isn't current law. And let's face it, this state and the rest of the states face an enormous threat to our health care system from the loss of the Affordable Care Act. Now, I know some of you don't like the Affordable Care Act. Obviously, Republicans in Congress and the President don't like the Affordable Care Act. But not liking it doesn't help us decide what are we going to do when they repeal it, and we don't know what they're going to replace it with, if anything. I think the one thing that's very clear is they don't know what to do. Although they took the 60 or so votes to repeal in the past, they never knew what to do instead. So I think it's worth remembering that the Affordable Care Act was actually based on what were some Republican ideas once upon a time. It was based on the private market. It was an attempt, as I've said all along, I think it was an attempt to keep private insurance in the game because private insurance was so dysfunctional. It worked for some people, but for many, many people, it did not work. And Minnesota was always struggling to try to make things better, and we did. We did better than a lot of states because we were willing to tax our private insurers to make them help pay for our high-risk pool and some other things like that. So we were kind of ahead of the game as a state. But I think that we would really be smart to put forward contingent budgets, or at least to, you know, not to just keep going along as though there's no elephant in the room, because there is. And we could be, even once we're out of session, we could suddenly find out that all the money that came to us from the ACA is being pulled and that we're being block granted in Medicaid and that suddenly we're going to have to totally rethink our systems in Minnesota and we won't even be in session. That could happen. So I think it would be very smart if we could kind of, everything that we do here this session, be thinking about what if, you know, have it kind of on the two tracks. Otherwise, I think we're being really pretty irresponsible. I also just wanted to say a couple things about pieces that were mentioned. You know, a public option, if we lose a lot of federal money, we're going to have to figure out what to do with our Minnesota Care program. We're going to have to figure out what to do with a lot of Minnesotans who are going to simply lose access to health insurance. You know, public option may actually be something that could be useful to us in that circumstance, depending on how it's done. Also, the chair mentioned the provider tax, and it's true in this budget, the governor is using the provider tax in a way that assumes that things are going to keep going the way they are. But one thing I think would be very, very foolish of us is to completely get rid of that source of funding, as we're on track to do if we don't make changes, given that we're going to lose federal funding. We don't know how much. We don't know what requirements will come with that loss. But we know we're going to lose funding. And if we care about having Minnesotans have access to health care, and if we care about keeping our hospitals afloat and our rural providers afloat, and, you know, we have a very important health care industry in this state, and if we care about keeping all of that going, I think we should hang on to that source of funding. We probably should make some changes to it. Maybe to make it more fair, maybe to make it more broad-based, but for us to just simply let that sunset, I think would be a huge mistake at this point, given what we may be facing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lohman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, thank you for the testimony today, Mr. Piper. The question I have about the public option is, will they be setting up reserves? You know, you say that's going to be self-funded or premium-based. And to Representative Grunhagen's comments and Representative Levy's comments, the things that we've done publicly so far have not worked out. And, you know, by the way, contending that it's a negative thing to not know what we're going to replace it with because we don't know what we're going to do, I can tell you as an insurance professional, there are people that put together what we have right now, and I think they're well-intended. But frankly, they didn't know what to do either, but they went ahead anyway, and now we have what we have. And so I think caution is important. I agree we need to take a hard look at if we're going to get rid of a funding source, a safety net, if you will. But to the public option, is there going to be a reserve set up for that, or will there be guarantees that if, in fact, the losses escalate, that it's going to get put back on premium payers and not on the public sector?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lunan. So we would procure similar to the way we procure public health care programs. So we contract with managed care organizations, with insurance companies that have reserve requirements for our public health care programs already. Additionally, for non-traditional managed care, we have our Integrated Health Partnership program, which is a risk-sharing relationship, and we're happy to provide you more information about that as well. But so we have the HMOs that we contract with already who have the reserves necessary to ensure risk-bearing, and then we also have our separate Integrated Health Partnership directly with providers to do risk sharing. So happy to provide you more information about that.
Representative Lohman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for that information. The I've looked at this a lot. I come from this for over 30 years, and I am not only of the opinion that we should not do a public option, but it shouldn't even be a private option. It should be a personal option. The future of healthcare is going to be health. People doing preventative things to make sure they don't have to access the lousy coverage that they're going to get or the partial coverage that they're going to get set up. And people act differently when somebody else is buying. You go to a wedding, and there's a cash bar, and there's an open bar. I'm going to give everybody a minute. I saw a study on this, and what it was is at that open bar, there was 4% more alcohol consumed than at a cash bar. There was 35% more alcohol sold. I'm going to give you a minute. After that open bar wedding, the bartender, the waitress went around, and after everyone left, and they dumped out all the half beers and half drinks because there wasn't a consequence for utilization. When we finally have the political stomach to fix this, we are going to have to put the consumers to work. That's where the solution lies. And the consumers are going to have to bring the price market in, and that won't be a public, somebody else is paying for it option. Yes, we have much fewer uninsured people right now, but we have more people not paying for their insurance, their health insurance, than we've had. So it's basically how you're, you know, that's semantics and how you're looking at it. But the bottom line is going to be the consumers have to bring cost. There's nothing, including the carriers, there's nothing putting a downward pressure on the cost of health care. And that is the root of the problem. We go around, we keep clipping off a leaf here and a little twig here, and we have to go after the root of what will put a pressure on bringing competition, on bringing market back into healthcare. It's so far out there right now that not only do you not shop, you don't even know what it costs till after you bought it. And so that's the systemic problem in this. And so we should be thinking of is solutions that go towards that.
Thank you, Representative Lunin. And if you want to distribute that study that you referenced for the rest of the committee, that would be great. Commissioner, anything to wrap up?
No, thank you. I just really appreciate the time, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you very much. And Lauren Coleman and Claire Wilson are here next. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go in whatever batting order you would like.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Certainly good to see you all again. And we will try to be as brief but as explanatory as possible this afternoon.
Excuse me.
Well, I'm Lauren Coleman.
If you could, do you have the budget books that we have in front of you? If you can, if you're going to be referencing those, if you could just go to direct page numbers so that members can flip through along with you. So it's kind of difficult to follow along. So if you do have page references to the budget book, if you could make those directly, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in the upper right corner of the slides that you will see will be a reference to the budget pages. So, and we'll point those out as we go on. So I'm Lauren Coleman. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care for Older Adults. And with me?
I'm Claire Wilson, Assistant Commissioner for the Community Supports Administration.
We have a long history in Minnesota of continuously improving services for older adults and people living with disabilities, but we always know that we can do better. And so we want to empower our program participants to have more choices over their lives, where they live, where they work, how and where they are active in their communities. So that is really the theme behind what we're trying to accomplish in this set of budget activities.
So in our home and community-based services area, we really are looking at two key goals, and that is allowing people to live as independently as possible and in the settings of their choice, and also really supporting them to work independently and in the settings of their choice. So to achieve these two major goals, we are going to have to look at reform in the way we pay for services and the way we deliver services. So the first proposal that we'll go a little bit more in depth with is found on page 12 through 19 of the budget book. And this is updating our disability waiver rate setting services. And again, we need to update this not just to allow us to remain in federal compliance, but also to allow and ensure access to these services. So this is a complex proposal that has a couple of moving parts. One is that we are removing after modeling budget neutrality factors that were put into place. CMS has required us to remove these by 2018. We're also looking at increasing the rate that's paid for respite care services. Now, as we face the workforce shortage, we know that more family members are being dependent on to provide services, and we know through exceptions that are requested through the rate setting process that these services aren't being paid at a rate that's sustainable. These are really critical services. These family members need their respite, so this provides for an increase in those rates. It's also been identified that transportation is a real gap, really across the service area, across the state. So this also allows for a contracted study of how to do rate setting methodology for transportation services to support people to be able to get to their employment services and their living settings. Now, this proposal also supports this move that the commissioner was speaking about in terms of moving us to a community integrated employment system that really supports people who now are expecting and hoping to work in the community to do so. So this adds three new employment services that will allow providers to really help transition people into employment and support them in employment when that's their choice. Now, the way that this fairly significant investment is offset is we are eliminating the ability for day training and rehabilitation providers to bill for a partial day of services. So they will now bill, would be required to bill in 15-minute units, and therefore really being more accountable to the hours and the work that's occurring, and also really allowing for individualized billing. So those are proposals to address employment. And to address housing, we'll move to pages 20 through 27 of your budget book. This is expanding access to community living opportunities. Now, this proposal has a couple of different components as well. And I will say that there is, for those of you following along at home or closely reading in your budget pages books, which I know is many of you, there is a line in this change page that says that GRH is to be sunsetted. That is not what's happening. No one panic. We are not sunsetting GRH. We're simply proposing that the name be changed to housing support to better reflect the program as an income support program, which it is, rather than making it sound like a provider type. Now, what we are doing with this proposal is expanding Minnesota Supplemental Housing Assistance to those who are currently in GRH settings, so allowing those people to move out into settings of their own and making that benefit more affordable. So moving it from where it is currently at $194 to $366 so that people can access that income assistance and afford their own living. And this is projected once operationalized in fiscal year 17 to result in over 1,400 people being able to access or maintain their housing. The other piece of this, as the commissioner mentioned, is moving housing transition services and housing tenancy support services, so seeking housing and maintaining housing, into the Medicaid benefit set. This would be an investment of close to $8 million in order to operationalize this. Now, the cost of that is offset by looking at what is our current GRH supplemental service rate and reducing it for those MA-eligible individuals by 50%, because some of those services they will now be accessing through Medicaid, and it prevents a duplication of services. And it's also looking at a few very site-specific GRH providers who are receiving a current enhanced rate above the supplemental service rate to provide services to essentially the same population as other providers are providing at the standard rate. So reducing that from an enhanced rate to the standard rate. And all of this is really supported by an investment in the infrastructure of this program. So really looking at paying counties and tribes to administer the benefit, which has not occurred in the past, and also really supporting housing navigation services so that people can know about this benefit, access this benefit, and we can help to really assure that people are able to achieve and maintain that housing. And once those housing benefits are operationalized, as the commissioner said, we expect that's another 5,000 people who will either be able to maintain living in the community or achieve living in the community. The next three, this slide actually combines three different proposals, so it may be hard to track me, but it's pages 28 through 30, 35 through 36, and 33 through 34. They kind of operate together though, so I'll just give you a high level. One is managing the corporate foster care moratorium and allowing for two new exceptions to that to keep people healthy and safe in the housing of their choice. One is that we're sunsetting the residential waiver care service. That will end in fiscal year 18. This will allow an exception to the corporate foster care moratorium so those individuals who choose to could transition to foster care. And the other is that there are currently some settings that have the characteristics of what should be a licensed setting, but they're currently unlicensed. So looking at those settings and in instances when they should be licensed and people want to stay, allowing them to access that level of care. There is also in this proposal increasing the number of hours that an individual PCA is able to bill to 310 hours. Currently, that billing is limited to 275 hours, but people receiving services can be authorized for more hours, so up to 310. So this assures that their individual PCA could bill for those same hours of service, ensuring continuity of care and really addressing some of those workforce shortages that we're facing. The offset to these proposals is, as the Commissioner mentioned, limiting the number of hours that residential service providers are able to bill to accurately reflect the vacancy rate that's already built into their rate. So currently there's an assumption that there's up to 15 days where people may not actually be in service, but that's built into the rate. So now providers will be able to bill for 350 days, bringing that into alignment with the vacancy rate. The next proposal I'm going to touch on is sustaining our deaf and hard of hearing services. This is easy, page 52 through 55. The state, as you are aware, operates regional deaf and deaf and hard of hearing services throughout the state. There was temporary funding in 2015 for access to mental health services. These are really critical services for this community. So this fairly modest investment of $2.1 million sustains that funding and allows continued access to those mental health services. It also creates a psychiatric consultation service for people who are deaf and deafblind, which of course, if you can imagine, it's difficult enough to access psychiatry services for most Minnesotans, but really being able to access culturally and linguistically appropriate services is vital for this community. It also proposes modernizing the current statutes for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Division. Those statutes haven't been updated since 1980. We've had a slight shift in technology since 1980, and so that division would like to explore how to better provide their services. And finally, the last proposal I will touch on is pages 49 through 51. This is establishing fair payment rates for PCA services. This meets the contractual obligation between the state and the self-directed personal care assistants represented by SEIU. It proposes the following for all providers, raising the wage floor to $13 an hour, increasing paid time off, and establishing holiday pay time. So this represents a 3.9% rate increase effective July 1, 2017, to reflect the wage and PTO costs that were negotiated. It includes a 0.1% rate increase on July 1, 2018 for the holidays. And then it also proposes a 10% rate increase to PCAs serving people with complex needs. So these are people who have hours of service authorized above 12 and over hours a day of service. So people with really complex needs, hoping that we can better align their service needs with the rate.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my turn. One thing I've learned in my career, if you find something that's working, do more of it. So Return to Community is a program that we launched a few years ago that has really helped over 4,000 individuals move from care centers back home again. The unique aspect of this program is that it is predominantly privately paying individuals that had a desire to move back home and with some support from a community living specialist was able to achieve that. Why is that important to the state budget? Because it helps individuals not spend down and need to go on public programs. So we have additional work to do in this area that will help additional groups of people who are discharging from hospitals, people who are discharging from Medicare home care, other individuals who want to return home and live independently. A new feature to this proposal is addressing caregiver burnout. The foundation of our long-term service and support system is really family, neighbors, interested people. They are the foundation of caregiving. And family members at points in time get exhausted and they just can't do it any longer, or they're spending money out of pocket to support their loved one remaining at home. So this is trying to address the caregiver issue for families that are on the verge of not being able to do it any longer, thereby resulting in a family member needing to go to a senior housing or a care center. I might note that this program has received a couple very, what I would deem are distinguished awards. One is the Humphrey School Better Government Award, and just recently has been awarded a Bright Idea Award from Harvard University's Innovation in American Government Awards. So that is the return to community. It has an investment in the first biennium to ramp up for these additional groups of individuals, but then it produces savings in the next biennial budget. The next topic, found on page 63 to 65, is the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center. This is an initiative that was part of Reform 2020 that we passed several years ago, that was launched about a year and a half ago, which centralized reporting for suspicion of maltreatment abuse throughout Minnesota. Previous to this, we had 160-some telephone numbers that you would call if you had a concern, depending on what time of day it was, depending on where you live, depending where the individual you thought was being mistreated lived. So this centralized into a single toll-free number along with a web-based reporting system. We did project an increase. Unfortunately, we projected an increase that was lower than reality. So we have experienced a 161% increase in reports. Not to be assumed that it means that maltreatment has increased, but we're getting more reports. We're getting people to notice, both mandated reporters as well as the public. So it's working. But the budget that was set for this, as well as the budget for the technology to support this initiative, is running a deficit, and if we're going to adapt to this comprehensive way of reporting maltreatment and abuse, we need to request additional funds. We have a variety of other proposals within our areas. We have the HCBS settings rule, which we've been working on for a number of years. It's a federal rule that came out a few years ago. It's given us a transition time to determine whether the people living in the various settings that we're paying for within home and community-based service funds are actually meeting the criteria with community living. Both housing, employment, all of the Medicaid funding services that we use. We've worked extensively with stakeholders to try to define the criteria, to try to refine it, to try to figure out who is who's safe and what they're doing meets the person-centered planning rules, privacy, kind of consumer-oriented features. And those that are clearly not home and community-based, such as institutions, those we know won't meet this rule, but they weren't intended to meet this rule. But then you have a group in the kind of the middle zone that might have to modify their practices, might have to change what they're doing. So this is giving some funding for us to work with those hundreds of providers to help them achieve compliance with this federal rule. The risk is loss of federal funding. If we don't come into compliance with what we have proposed to the federal government, then our waiver funding could be at risk. There's also a variety of ideas that have kind of percolated over the last number of years that we're proposing to dive deeper, such as individual budgets, consolidation of disability waivers. Are any of these ideas that we've kind of nibbled around the edges, are they going to produce better results? And so you have a variety of ideas within the budget pages, and there's too many budget pages to mention, but you see them in the corner. that, again, is along the line of continuously improving, searching for the next best ideas. The other one I want to touch on is value-based reimbursement system. A couple of years ago, this legislature passed a new payment system for nursing facilities, and we are now, a year and some months into implementing it, and we have learned a lot. It's been 20 years since we've had a cost-based system for nursing facilities. It is bringing back, is triggering all those details that we tried to anticipate in the bill, but didn't get it exactly right. So we've been working with the imperative to try to clarify, well, what's the definition of nursing supplies versus housing supplies? How do you characterize different class categories? We've learned a lot. We need to clarify some things. We need to modify some things. We want to consolidate the numbers of time during the year that there's a rate change at a facility, because there's multiple triggers that will cause a rate change. And if you think about privately paying individuals, to get rate changes every 3 months, as you know, getting it once a year is confusing, but getting it multiple times during the year is really overwhelming. So we're trying to consolidate to the January 1 date that is the new rate year, but then allow for some adjustments July 1 for things like banking of beds or improvements to the facility that we recognize in their rates. So there's only two times a year that we would have rate changes. We want to eliminate duplicate costs. For example, a few years ago, the legislature recognized the effect of minimum wage increases on care centers, and facilities have been able to apply for a rate change, and we've granted that where they've documented that a state minimum wage has created additional costs. Well, in the new, that was under the old system. In the new system, those costs become part of your cost basis. So that rate increase that you received a couple years ago shouldn't be duplicative forever. So those should kind of fade away as those timelines become part of your cost basis. We also are proposing in here ongoing evaluation. There was one-time funding for an evaluation of the new system. We believe we should be evaluating the goals of the system and the outcomes of the system on an ongoing basis. So there are some resources to do that. Last topic I'm going to talk about is an assisted living report card. We have about a 10-year-old nursing facility report card that we believe has been very successful. We, again, have worked with stakeholders to identify the criteria. They are published. It's used by consumers and family members and others to compare how a facility is doing, what their staffing levels are, what their quality scores are, all of those elements to be an informed consumer. Well, assisted living has become the growth industry. We now have far more assisted living units than we have nursing facility beds. So we want to develop a similar, not necessarily identical, but a similar public report card on assisted living based upon defined criteria. Foundational are consumer interviews. That is what's so unique about the nursing facility report card, because we get a quality score based upon direct feedback from nursing home residents. And that, in some of our judgments, is the best test. What is the quality of life for the people who are using the service? So a similar effort to develop an assisted living report card over a 4-year timeline that would produce that public report card information to empower the consumer to select the best option for their circumstances. And we'll stand for questions.
All right, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question back on an earlier thing, but I think we've kind of moved on since then. But one of the questions I did have was, I really like the theme that's through many of these different areas of, you know, promoting independence and compliance with the Olmstead settlement, getting more people into situations of their choice with maximum opportunities. And yet I didn't see in some of your proposals related to housing and some other areas any adjustments related to housing costs. And we know that there's not one housing market in Minnesota. There's not one housing market in the metro or in greater Minnesota. And I'm wondering if you, since much of the funding is state-only funding through GRH or MSA, if you, in looking at your proposals, had really looked at varying that based on the typical rental or housing costs within a community.
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, something like, so, I mean, well, first, sorry. I know who you are. You know, that is one reason why, you know, of course, there's not areas that we necessarily have impact on in terms of affordable housing within this, you know, within our budget. But it was certainly one of the areas of consideration in terms of proposing to increase the supplemental assistance benefit, you know, to reflect how unaffordable housing has become and how difficult it is to afford it with our current income supports programs.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I hope you'll give that even some more thought, because even within my county, within Hennepin County, you'll end up with the clustering of people with disabilities, vulnerable adults in certain areas, just because that's the only place affordable housing exists within our community, and people who'd love to live near their family in the communities in which they grew up in the suburbs, there just is nothing out there that within our kind of budgets they can even begin to think about living in the community that they probably went to school in, that they have friendships and relationships with, probably have connections that might even lead to that job. But if we don't acknowledge that in our formulas, we're going to continue to ghettoize people. It may not be within institutions or group living situations, but it's going to be just because of the economy of where affordable housing is or isn't. And the other question I had was on your return to community, which I think you've done, you know, shown some good work. Have you looked at that as a model to expand to assisted living? Because I think we also see people going to assisted living post a major event in their life, that the kind of thing that leads them to nursing homes, and then they never leave. And I think there might be some opportunities there too.
Mr. Chair and Representative, two things on assisted living. One, several years ago, we advanced an initiative, and it was passed by the legislature to interact with people who are considering assisted living prior to making that decision, to make sure that they know what their options are prior to leaving their home, selling their furniture, doing those kinds of things that make it very difficult to return once you've moved into assisted living. It doesn't prevent people from moving into assisted living. And so we did slow the growth of people moving before they really needed to. Secondly, the assisted living population is a targeted population for return to community, and we are working with that service sector to help people return to a more independent setting if they wish to do so.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to your reform on substance abuse, substance use disorder treatment system, and if the members recall the problem we had with detox centers closing, that counties were, you know, it was too expensive for counties. And then also the statistics you have here with the only 1 in 10 are receiving any sort of comprehensive treatment. And so this, to me, is an example of taking a problem, and then the department goes and figures out a way to we call it reform. But to me, it's innovative. It's something that you show that it's going to result in the savings. But could you talk a little bit more about exactly the entire shift and how much that's going to change, and the focus? What I'm really interested in is how we're focusing, starting to understand about medically monitored withdrawal or providing withdrawal management services. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Ms. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Allen, so tomorrow I think we're going to do a presentation, a little bit, a deep dive into the substance use disorder reform, so I'm happy to go into more detail there. But thank you for recognizing that it is a significant reform, so I look forward to talking in depth about the different proponents of that.
Thank you.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I want to have a follow-up. The PCA minimum wage that you talked about a minute ago, could you tell me what percentage of the PCAs in the state that this will affect?
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, so the negotiated rate will impact all the providers, all the PCA providers who are self-directed. So the bargaining unit, of course, negotiated the rate, but then the rate gets, you know, included in the Medicaid rate for these services, and so it's for all providers of the PCA services.
In other words, the people in Greater Minnesota that are working in, that are PCAs and direct support staff, that will not cover them. Is that correct?
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so this covers the self-directed workforce. So the self-directed PCA workforce, the consumer-directed support budget folks, and then the consumer grant workers.
And that's, would I be correct in saying that that's primarily in the Twin Cities area?
Ms. Wilson.
There's something here I'm not understanding, obviously.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I may not be explaining it crystal clear, but these services are provided throughout the state by the workforce that is providing personal care attendant services, so the self-directed workforce. The bargaining unit is a particular, are those who have elected to be in the union and are the self-directed workers, so the PCA choice providers. But when they negotiate their rate, it then is moved into the Medicaid rate and is, therefore applied for all providers of those services.
Thank you for trying to help me understand. I think I may need to talk to Representative Loeffler for a few minutes afterwards.
Representative Backer.
Chair, thank you. You did a quick overview here. My question is with some of the reductions that we've heard, are you passing on some of that to the counties or other groups? Some of that cost savings on your agency to another agency? That would be my question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the offsets that I mentioned in the proposals, many of those are reforms to the rates. So they will be felt, of course, in some instances by providers. Some are offset by what we intend to capture either in federal funding, so when benefits are moved into the or when services are moved into the benefits, that will capture some of that through federal funding, and then through eliminating services that would be duplicative.
Chair and Ms. Wilson, if I could get a list of the ones that would offset with the providers, I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the reforms you're promoting, because obviously with the baby boomers coming up, we need to look at everything and try to make it more efficient. But one of the things I always wonder about nursing homes is, and I've had relatives and father-in-law in nursing homes for long-term Alzheimer's and stuff, so they do great work. I appreciate it. But when you do look at the cost, you do wonder, if I give you a dollar to help you out with nursing homes, how much of that disappears at the state level? How many, how much of it goes for administration? How much of it is actually paid to the staff who take care of the patients? In other words, like my father-in-law was in with Alzheimer's, I think it was $6,500 a month, and he was in a dual room. And the other person was a quadriplegic, so I don't know what they were paying, but I assume it's pretty close because it goes on dependencies, as you well know. If you can't feed yourself, you can't toilet yourself, you can't dress yourself, and it goes on and on. But the higher the cost, and my father-in-law was in a position where he needed help with everything. But I often wondered, if I give you a dollar to help out a nursing home, where does that disappear in the process? And, you know, I hate to bring this up, but when I was on the school board, they used to do an annual audit, and they'd give us current costs of our different programs, then they do comparative data with other school districts, and then they give us historical data, like the last 5 years or 3 years, I think it was. And for a layperson, that was the only way to evaluate, you know, where your money was going. And I have yet to ever see an analysis like that where you have comparative and historical data on where the money's flowing inside the nursing home facilities. And I've asked for it locally a couple of times, and I don't seem to show up for some reason. But is there anything like that available?
Mr. Chair and Representative Brudenhagen, well, one of the benefits of the value-based reimbursement system returning to a cost-based system is that we will get annual costs from each Medicaid-certified facility in the state. And those cost reports are broken down into nursing costs, social worker costs, administrative costs, utilities, all of those kinds of things. That is part of the evaluation that that I spoke with earlier about, is the system producing the outcomes that it was designed to?
Right.
Has it had an impact on worker retention? Has it had an impact on being competitive in the marketplace? We're in the early stages of being able to determine, because remember, we've just got 1 year of experience so far.
Okay.
And so those cost reports are coming in. We did what was what we refer to as an interim cost report, because we know everybody's anxious to know where did the money go. And so we've got some early data. It's not audited. It's still pretty global. But over time, you will be able to see exactly where the money is going in this sizable investment that the state of Minnesota made in this particular service.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I had a question along the same lines as Representative Grunhagen. So on the value-based reimbursement system for nursing homes, which I actually would call cost-based, because I think it is what we're basing it on, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about that, but really my question was, and I don't think you quite covered this for him, but are we going to get some reports that compare the new expenditures versus what we would have been spending under the old system, so that we can see? I don't know if everybody understands that now we're in a, now we've put nursing homes in the forecast. We're no longer going to have, you know, have it come back to us and say how much do we want to appropriate in this budget. It's now in the forecast. So we need to have a way that we can kind of track and see what this new system, this cost-based system, is costing us as compared to what we would have been spending before. Are we going to be able to make that comparison?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, I think we will, and we're beginning to see that data. How many facilities increase wages, and in what cost categories? How many facilities are providing health insurance that didn't do so before, or reduce premiums to their employees? But that's the kind of data that we're going to be able to extract from these cost reports. We, as much as you, want to know where is the money going and is it doing something. The reason value-based is in the descriptor is there's a unique feature in this cost-based system, and truly it is cost-based, but it was very intentional to say we don't want to just pay cost, but we want to measure quality. And for those facilities that are delivering higher quality, we're okay with their cost being higher. But if their quality is not there, perhaps they shouldn't be able to float up to the highest cost categories until they deliver the kind of quality that we want. So that's the value comparison that is embedded into the value-based system. You have to spend the money and deliver a high-quality score.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee.
Thank you. Well, I guess one could debate whether it should be called value-based or cost-based, but But anyway, and I'm glad we're going to be getting those kinds of measures, but I'm also just interested in the overall cost measure. And that requires some calculation of what would have been spent by the state under the old system. And that's why I'm particularly interested in whether you're going to be making that calculation as part of what you're going to be reporting to us.
Mr. Chair, Representative, certainly the forecast will accommodate the increased spending. It's going to be a challenge to try to predict what would the spending have been otherwise. There'll have to be some assumptions based upon what other decisions would the legislature have made or what other consumer decisions would have been made along the way, but we can attempt to demonstrate what the cost curve looks like.
Thank you.
All right. Seeing no other questions, I think what we're going to do is break here since we don't have time to start another section. We're going to start out with health tomorrow, and then we're going to do DHS on Wednesday, health on Thursday, and then next week we're going to do on Tuesday, Venture DHS, Wednesday boards, and then Thursday mop up on DHS and anything else that we need to move up. That would be the 9th. With that, we are adjourned.